from the Theology of the Body Institute. This is
the Ask Christopher West podcast. Hi, podcast listeners.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode. We are so happy you have tuned in wherever you are around the globe. We do have a global listenership, which
it's
is pretty
true.
Exciting.
Yes.
Hey, remember when we were in Paris and one of our listeners looked up our itinerary? She wasn't on the pilgrimage, but she's from Paris.
Right.
And she came out to where we were just to say hello. Her name was Eleanor, am I remembering?
Eleanor, yes.
Shout out to Eleanor.
Hi, Eleanor.
Eleanor, thank you for coming to say hi. That was really fun.
That was. And we had podcast listeners from different countries in the world join us on that pilgrimage. And I think there's some new listeners now that learned about it from the pilgrimage.
That's right.
So hi, everybody.
And we promised we'd do a couple more episodes where we shared some of the things we experienced on the pilgrimage. So maybe this will be the last episode we do that, and then we'll move on to other little banter in the future. You know, another pilgrim from the pilgrimage said to me that he really likes our banter on the podcast. He said, keep doing that banter. That makes me laugh. So we're glad people enjoy it.
That's right.
So this was the pilgrimage was a themed pilgrimage where we were following in the heart and teachings of Saint Therese. We were in France, after all, and we went to Lisieux. Did I say that correctly?
You said
Wendy?
It so well.
Because I've butchered it so many times.
Nice, I like
Lisieux. How was that?
The first one was better, but
I'm
let's
thinking
move on.
Of Inspector Clouseau.
Yeah.
Lisieux. Yes. Did I? Dang it! I can't say it. I got it right the first time. That's all. Okay, I'll just leave it there. So we were there in that town that I'm not going to say the name of again, and we had a moving experience together, seeing the statue of the Blessed Mother, the actual statue. And if you know the life of Therese, there's this scene. Maybe you can explain that scene in her life, Wendy.
This statue had belonged to the family, to her family. Therese was the youngest of five girls, and specifically, I think, to her own mother. And it had been just a sign of their devotion to Mary, and part of their gathering for prayer would sometimes include the statue. And there was a very significant time in Therese's life as a child, when she was only 10 years old, where she was very ill for a number of months. The family was terribly concerned about her, and she was staying in her bedroom, but they moved the family statue of the Blessed Mother into her bedroom because they were gathering to pray there for her. And Therese, who had been just barely coherent, and she remembers this, and she talks about it in her own autobiography, had an experience where she was looking at the statue, but then she began to see, like, the real Blessed Mother. And
so it wasn't just that the statue came to life, which is sometimes how the story is told.
But no.
The statue was like an inspiration for her to see the Blessed Mother.
Yeah, as she's looking at the statue, she saw the face of the Blessed Mother smiling at her, smiling. And that experience, that exchange, you know, of that love coming from Mary to Therese, and it was a miraculous healing experience. And that statue itself is called, it has a name, Our Lady of Victories, which was just a title of Mary that was also very meaningful to their mm-hmm. family. So what were you going to say about
that? I was just going to say, we there in Lisieux, we saw this actual statue, mm-hmm. and it's above a reliquary that has relics of Therese. And it, you know, it's just a piece of history in the life of a saint who has meant so much to you, Wendy, so much to me. Your middle name is Teresa after Therese. Mm-hmm. And you introduced me. I mean, I had heard of Therese, of course, growing up as a Catholic, but you were the first one really to say, you know, you should spend some time with mm-hmm. Story of a Soul, which I had never read. And to be there with you and knowing how meaningful that experience was for Therese.
Yes.
And it's like, I don't know, like if you could put it in superhero terms, it's like seeing Luke Skywalker's lightsaber or something. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that kind. It's not a myth, though. The Star Wars is a myth. This is not a myth. This was a real woman.
Yeah.
She really had this experience. It really changed her life. We really saw the same statue. And it was, you know, it puts a connection, a real incarnate connection. It's like a flesh and blood experience of something you've read about in a book that had a real impact. And that was meaningful to me.
That was for me, too. Yeah, ever since I was a teenager and read her autobiography, I just had a desire to see that statue, just to feel the connection with people that through reading of them, I had grown to love. And by them, I mean Therese and her family.
Yeah.
So that was really wonderful. Do you have any updates for us on the TOB Institute to share?
Yes, I have an update for you that I didn't share last week when I was talking about all the courses coming up. We have a very busy January at the TOB Institute. We have The Way of Beauty at the beginning of the month. We have Sexual Integration and Redemption at the end of the month.
Mm-hmm.
Or is it Sexual Integration and Redemption or Redemption and Integration? One or the other. It's the same course, but it doesn't really matter which order.
I think Integration comes first in the name.
Sexual Integration and Redemption. Yes, because we call it SIR.
Okay, there you go.
Sexual Integration and Redemption. Thank you, Wendy. Mm-hmm. But what I failed to mention last week is the third week of January, I will be teaching Love and Responsibility in Sydney, Australia.
Oh, that's right.
Outside of Sydney, Australia. And can I tell you, why don't you tell everybody, Wendy, what happened when you and I were in the airport in Paris? And I was talking to the customer service rep at American Airlines. What happened?
Okay, so this is a really long flight.
It's a 15-hour really... flight from Los Angeles to good
and
night.
Christopher travels a lot, and he is weary, and he's been wondering whether with all the miles of travel that he has.
So I get these certificates with all the miles, all the traveling I do. I get these upgrade certificates. They're called system-wide upgrades. And these are the treasured possession to have system-wide upgrades, because it means if you get a system-wide upgrade from LA to Sydney, it's the difference between 15 hours of torture or 15 hours of peace and relaxation, because you have a bed, a flat bed, and a little cubby all to yourself if you get one of those system-wide upgrades. And we had to talk to customer service when we were in Paris flying back. And I said, hey, can you I applied for this system-wide upgrade, but you never know usually until the day of. So it's like months of torture. Like, am I going to get it? And what happened?
They said yes.
I got the system-wide upgrade on my flight to Sydney. And what did I do?
You did a little dance right there in the airport.
I was so delighted. I danced. I danced in the airport.
The French customer service guy said to me, what did he have for breakfast?
But then the other French lady said,
no, I understand.
Yeah, she got me. She knew why I was dancing. Anyway, I didn't talk about Sydney to tell you that I was dancing in the airport, although I thought that was funny, so we should include it. What I was talking about was I'm teaching Love and Responsibility in the third week of January. Check out the link below. If you are in that part of the world, Australia, New Zealand, or if you want to go on a grand adventure from any other part of the world to fly to Australia and take Love and Responsibility with yours truly, I would love to have you as a student.
And do they register for that through the same method, or is that different?
Yeah, we will put up, I think it's linked through our website, but if not, it's linked through the Sydney Archdiocese, because we're entering into a partnership with the Archdiocese of Sydney to bring mm-hmm. Theology of the Body to Australia. So we'll have the appropriate link, whichever it
okay.
is, we'll have it up there.
Wonderful.
Yeah, it might not, you're right, Randy, it might not be the normal link. So just look at all the links, and when you see the one for Sydney, click that one if you want to come.
Very good. You ready for a question?
I am. I'm ready.
I thought you might want to say something about this episode in a special thing that we're doing.
Oh, that's right. Mm-hmm. We have a backlog of patron questions, right? So we give priority to our patrons in answering questions. It's usually the first question of every episode goes to a patron. Just a little incentive, a way of thanking all the people who support our work. Please, please, please continue to do so. Thank you so much for all those who are patrons. And if you are not a patron, if you are blessed by what we're doing here at the Theology Body Institute, would you consider becoming a patron? You can check out the link below. We offer all kinds of exclusive formation and benefits to our patrons. Won't get into that now. You can click the website to learn more. But because we have a backlog of patron questions, we are devoting this entire episode to our patrons with a tip of the hat, deep gratitude for your monthly support of our mission. Truly, truly, we cannot do it without you. So all the questions this episode are coming from patrons.
First question is from an anonymous patron. I am 21 years old and really think I'm called to marriage. I study at a Catholic university that has unfortunately not been faithful to its Catholic identity. In my first year in college, I really tried dating seriously with a particular girl for the first time, but it didn't really work out. Right now, I think I'm still at the phase where I'm trying to heal from the heartbreak she caused me, though perhaps it is safe to say that I've moved on enough that her memories don't really haunt me anymore. Mm. Nonetheless, there are other young women in my classes that I'm honestly smitten with. A lot of them are really attractive.
Can I just say how awesome I think that is, that honesty and the wide openness of his heart to allow himself to be smitten in that? I like it. It's good.
I feel like I'm being bombarded with beauty.
Beautiful. That's awesome.
Because of this, I really feel the urge of dating again and discerning marriage with any of the young women in my classes that I find beautiful. However, here's the big problem. Like I said, the university I'm attending isn't really faithful to its Catholic identity, and this is reflected in many students' ethical views.
Yes.
I find it really imprudent to ask a girl out if I already know in advance that her values will not be the same as mine, because it won't work out. What would be your advice in this kind of situation where it seems that my Eros wants to go wild?
Whoop, 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 whoop.
But thinks this time isn't the right time to, quote, unleash its power.
Yeah.
What would be good ways to remember that ultimately this Eros of mine really desires eternal nuptials in heaven? And should I take the risk of asking a girl out, even though she may not have the same faith as I do?
I love this guy. Whoever you are, brother, you're beautiful. And what I'm thinking of here is JP2 in Love and Responsibility, where he says, a readily roused sensuality is the stuff from which a rich, if difficult, personal life may be made. And as we allow the Lord into that readily roused sensuality, it can become a real force, a creative force to bring great good into this world. And I love his honesty. What did he say? How did he say, like, I feel like I want to marry all these women, or I want to, yeah. What did he say?
He said,
I want to date them all.
There are other young women I'm honestly smitten with. A lot of them are really attractive. I feel like I'm being bombarded with beauty.
Bombarded with beauty. Brother, you are being bombarded with beauty because every human being is beautiful. And I think you're feeling something of that and tasting something of that. And can I say, in answer to your question, how do I realize all this readily roused sensuality, all of this eros and attraction and yearning? How do I realize this is really a in my own language, God gave us eros to be like the fuel of a rocket that has the power to launch us to the stars, right? Brother, this being bombarded by beauty and attracted to this person and that person and this person, do not squash that. Redirect it towards heaven, because an integral part of heaven, something we call the communion of all the saints, the communion of all the saints. I once heard the communion of saints described as multiple intimacy without promiscuity. Now, please don't genitalize that. Genital union will cease, right? the union of man and woman in one flesh is a sign that points to an eternal reality of communion. But what we will have in the eternal communion is every man and woman who responds to the wedding invitation of eternity, in every man and every woman, all that is masculine will be in union with all that is feminine, and that one union will be the one bride who is forever in union with the bridegroom, Jesus Christ. Now, we use this language analogously, right? Marital language, spousal language. It's an analogy. Please don't take this in the wrong direction. I remember years ago, a student of mine once said, when I described heaven this way, the communion of saints, all that is masculine will be in union with all that is feminine, will be the one body, the one bride in union with Christ. He said, it sounds like you're describing an orgy. And I was revolted by that. I said, no. In fact, how many no's did I just say? That was a lot of no's.
I can't even count them.
No. It isn't. No. The orgy is, in fact, the diabolic mockery of the communion of saints, right? We are made by God to be in union with every human being. We are. That is our destiny, not in a sexual sense. But why did God make us sexual beings? Why do I have an exclusive, keyword, exclusive sexual relationship with you, Wendy? It's this mystery of learning how to love one person prepares me to learn how to love all. It's the mystery of particularity leading to universality, right? I need to learn how to love Wendy in this exclusive sense, in the sacrament of marriage, to prepare my heart to be expanded to love everyone in the communion of saints. And I really believe, you know, when we have temptations to infidelity in marriage, oh, I wish I could be with that person. But I can't be with that person because I'm married to this person. But I still feel this attraction. Well, okay. You can allow that to be untwisted and redirected towards the communion of saints because you are meant to love that person rightly for all eternity. And every woman you're being smitten by, bombarded by beauty, this is a little taste, a little glimmer we'll put it this way, it is an invitation from the Lord to direct your eros towards what awaits us in the communion of saints, where we will have multiplicity of intimacy without promiscuity, because it will be an intimacy beyond what we can think and understand or comprehend here and now. Now, I've said so much, I don't even remember what the question was. What was the question, Wendy? Did he have a question?
He did.
What was it?
That part of it, I think you're really speaking to, is about, he said, what would be good ways to remember that ultimately this eros of mine really desires heaven.
Right.
But then he also asks, should I take the risk of asking a girl out, even though she may not have the same faith?
Probably not. I mean, there are situations in which people who you might say are mismatched at the start of a relationship, God uses that and brings about a conversion in that person's life. But I think it's a mistake to say, I'm going to seek that out and my love for this person and my faith is going to convert this person. That I don't think that's the right approach. Now, we do have this story in the scripture of Hosea, right? The prophet Hosea, who Gomer is called to, or is Gomer the prostitute? Hosea is the guy who's called to marry Gomer, and Gomer's the prostitute. Am I getting that right?
Yeah.
I get these Bible people mixed up in my head sometimes. Yes, Hosea is called by the Lord to go marry a prostitute named Gomer. And I always stumble there because I think of Gomer Pyle.
Right.
And Gomer Pyle was not a woman. Anyway, that's why I always get that mixed up. Back on track. Christopher, think, what were you talking about? Bible story, gospel, or what's his name?
Hosea.
Called to marry the prostitute. So we do have this biblical example of somebody who's called to marry a wayward woman and to show that wayward woman divine love. And this becomes an image of the entire gospel story itself of Christ who comes to wed us, the wayward woman, right? The wayward lover. We've taken our loves to all these, we've prostituted ourselves. We've taken our loves to all these lesser, less wild loves, right? We are called to that wild love. And I love what he said about going wild. What did he say?
Sorry, I keep having to reread your question, Anonymous. All right, let's see what it says. Okay. I'm sorry.
Going wild with Eros. What am I supposed to do with this wild Eros? Or it's my wildest. My okay. Eros wants to go wild.
What would be your advice in this situation where it seems my Eros wants to go wild?
That's right, right. Your Eros wants to go wild. Yes, it does. Because you are born to be wild. Boom, 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 boom. But don't go wild in a horizontal way. If you allow your Eros to go wild in a horizontal way, you will end up at a frat party. You will end up in an orgy, right? This is a diabolic mockery of the wildness you're made for. You are called to go vertically wild, right? Listen to the words of that Steppenwolf song. Come on, baby, go and make it happen. Take the world in a love embrace. Fire all your guns at once and explode into space. Cause like a true nature's child, you are born to be wild. I wanna touch the sky and I never wanna die. Born to be wild. There it is. That's the launching towards the infinite. Right? This is why I call these rock and rollers the twisted mystics. Often their ideas are twisted up, but untwisted. And that's what I'm talking about. That's what you're really desiring. That wild Eros is vertical wildness. That's what launches you to the communion of the saints. That's what you're made for. Bless you, bless you, bless you. Be not afraid. And pray for me, because I'm afraid. That's wild stuff. All the saints, to be a saint is to allow your Eros to go vertically wild.
I agree with your sense of just this special sensitivity of heart that's coming through in this question. And there's a certain, like, sense of humor about himself.
Yeah, I feel it.
And a certain kind of
levity
yeah. And just an amazement that's coming through, a wonder. Yeah. That's all of that, I think, is so beautiful to affirm. And I think just that, like, if there's any cautions I feel is when you encounter that beauty that you're seeing, like, are you also asking the Lord, like, to bring about the best good of that other person for her own sake? Like,
amen.
Or do we see the beauty and think, oh, that beauty could make me happy. That right. beauty could, in sort of a way that we're trying to grasp at something for ourselves. And, you know, the tone wasn't that way, but it is just a caution I feel inside, because I know we're all fallen human beings and I can relate to it myself, you know, seeing when I've seen lots of handsome guys who seemed like nice people that I could trust, like, just those explosions of wondering, like, oh, God, who do you have for me? And could this be so amazing? And I mean, it's part of like normal developmental stage, right, I guess you could say. Right. But it has to mature into like a genuine knowing of a person that you genuinely desire the good of the other and, you know, are in a relationship that has good foundations. And I think that's why your instinct when he asked that about, you know, should I even ask a girl out if I know there's this great difference? Your instinct was to say, no, don't go that path, is just because that's more likely to get, I don't know, cause pain and confusion for one another rather than to discover we're on this same journey that we both understand, like, the dignity of our calling.
You just summed up, Wendy, so insightfully the whole of John Paul's book, Love and Responsibility, where he speaks of the raw material of love being found in that readily roused sensuality and affection we can have, kind of being attracted by the charm of another, the physical presence of the other, beauty of the other. All of that he calls the raw material of love. And he says, if this raw material is not held together by the correct gravitational pull, and what is the correct gravitational pull? It's the dignity of the person. Mm-hmm. Then that raw material, if it's not held together by the correct gravitational pull, adds up not to love, but its direct opposite, where we use the other person. Just as you said, mm-hmm. you know, the temptation is, oh, that person's beautiful. Can I grasp that beauty for myself because it pleases me?
Right.
Rather, allowing that readily roused attraction to become, how can I be a gift to this person? How can I get to know this person? How can I come to, as JP2 would say, not only desire that person as a good for me, but to desire that person's good, mm-hmm. even if it costs me. And it always costs us to desire the other person's good, no matter what, is always going to cost us. And this is where, when we're in it for ourselves, we are on shaky, shaky foundations. And he says the illusion of love, when it's based merely on attraction and sensuality and not on the dignity of the person, he says the illusion of love will eventually burst like a bubble and leave a terrible void. Hmm. And he says the goal of Love and Responsibility, the goal of that book, is to help people prevent that disillusionment, to prevent people from experiencing that disillusionment, to build love on solid foundations.
Yeah.
So I'm putting in another plug to come to Sydney, Australia in January to take the course on Love and Responsibility.
Our next question is from a patron named Catherine.
Hello, Catherine. Thank you, Catherine, for your support of our work every month. So grateful to you.
Thank you so much for the work you do to enrich our world with the beautiful teachings of the theology of the body. It has been so fruitful in my life. I help teach Sunday school at my local parish. When explaining the real presence of the body and blood of Christ in the Eucharist to third graders, one of the students asked why we aren't considered vampires if we are drinking Jesus' blood. I don't remember exactly how I answered this question, but I feel sure it could have been answered better. Can theology of the body shed any light on this rather random topic?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's rather random. I'd say you got a real thinker in the class, and I think that's pretty cool that he would even be willing to make that connection. So there's a basic principle we often reference here at the Theology of the Body Institute, and I put it this way. The devil doesn't have his own clay, right? For example, earlier I was saying the communion of saints is what we really yearn for, but the enemy gets his hands on that truth and he twists it and it becomes orgy, right? Well, vampirism, drinking the blood of another, is the enemy getting his hands on the profound, glorious, divine truth of the Eucharist and twisting it into a horror story, right? So the fact that this little kid is seeing that is profound. When we untwist that vampire thing, that bite into the neck of somebody else and suck the blood out of them, untwist that, what do we have? We have this yearning, rightly called eros. And we see it right in the opening line of the Song of Songs, where the bride cries out for the bridegroom and says, kiss me with the kisses of your mouth. Kiss me with the kisses of your mouth. Saint after saint, and I talk about this in my new book. I'd really encourage this listener in particular, but all the listeners out there, and yes, this is a shameless plug for my new book called Eating the Sunrise, Meditations on Liturgy and, catch this, Our Hunger for Beauty. Our Hunger for Beauty. I say in the book, let me pull it off my shelf here and see if I can actually find this section. Okay, so here, I just pulled this off the shelf and found this. It's on page 79, if anybody out there already has the book. Here's what I say. What are lovers saying with their opened mouth kisses? If not, I want to taste you, know you, take you into myself. They're saying quite literally, I adore you. Because adoration, as I explained, comes from the Latin ad ora, meaning at the mouth. And I had already said in the previous paragraph, you know, as newborn infants, what do we cry for the moment we're born? We cry for the breast of mama. Indeed, the very word mama, the most affectionate term we can come up with for mother, for mom, mama. Mama is Latin for breast, right? Mammary gland, right? Mama, mama. What is the function of the mammary gland? It's to turn blood into food, right? God has made us to be nourished by body and blood, right? This is what breastfeeding is, theology of the body. In his human nature, where did Christ learn that blood could become food? He learned this at his mother's breast, right? And the child takes the breast into its mouth, sucks in that blood that has become food, and it becomes life to that child. It's wired into us. You know, a few months later, this infant's going to become a toddler, is going to be crawling around and is going to be exploring the world. How does the infant learn about the world? Everything goes in the mouth. And we all learn the hard way. There are certain things you shouldn't put in your mouth. And we tend to think, well, when we grow up, we kind of get over that. No, 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 we don't. That desire to take into our mouths increases with a fiery passion when we hit puberty, right? This is what that passionate kissing is saying. I adore you. I'm at the mouth with you. And then I say, in the opening verses of the Song of Songs, the bride cries for her bridegroom, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. Reading this erotic love poetry with the mind of the church, this cry represents the yearning of every human heart for intimate knowledge of God. Then I quote St. Gregory of Nyssa. He says, the mouth of the bridegroom is the source from which springs the words of eternal life. If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. Drink. The vampire is the diabolic mockery of that holy desire to drink the very lifeblood of Jesus Christ. The whole reality, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. Saint after saint has told us this is fulfilled in the Eucharist. And here I quote in my book from Saint Cyril of Jerusalem. He says, when the body of Christ will touch your lips, then the wish of the bride from the Song of Songs will be fulfilled. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. The unity of love is then consummated. To sum up, the vampire sucking blood is the twisting of this good and holy desire that we see in lovers to take the other into himself or herself, to be nourished by that other, to eat that other. What are you saying in that big open mouth kiss? If not at some level, I want to eat you. I want to drink in your beauty. I want to be nourished by you. All of this is redeemed in the sacrament of the bridegroom and the bride. That's how John Paul II describes the Eucharist, the sacrament of the bridegroom and the bride. If that's new to you, if that's shocking to you, if that's scandalous to you, if that's intriguing to you, I invite you, please take up a study of this book, Eating the Sunrise, where I unpack these treasures in great detail. And I invite people to open wide their hunger and eat the sunrise. That's what the Eucharist is, because the sun comes forth like a bridegroom in the sky, Psalm 19 says. And every Mass, we're coming with our hunger to the bridegroom, the bride orienting her hunger to the coming of the bridegroom. Kiss me with the kisses of your mouth. This is our faith, as scandalous as that seems to these hyper-pious notions that are so rampant in the Catholic Church that really disincarnate things and make us suspicious of our desires. Saint after saint after saint knows that the Song of Songs brings us into the very essence of biblical faith, And what is the essence of biblical faith? Kiss me with the kisses of your mouth. It's the essence of biblical faith is this reality that the deepest desire of our heart for knowledge, for intimacy, can be super abundantly fulfilled in union with God. And it's don't super spiritualize it. The Eucharist is the concretization of that yearning to take into our mouths ultimate knowledge, ultimate nourishment, ultimate love. If the Eucharist is real, your mouth is the meeting place of heaven and earth, and your tongue is the throne of the living God. This communion, this intimacy happens mouth to mouth with God in adoration. This is our faith. I'm not making it up, as scandalous as it sounds.
That's some deep business. That's beautiful.
As that student said to me years and years ago,
yeah,
that's deep shit, Mr. West. Yes, it is.
This wasn't a third grader that was a ninth grader.
That was a high schooler, right.
Yeah. So in all of that, I just thought, I wonder if I should go back to Catherine and see if we can find a way that's helpful to a third grader.
Yeah, true enough.
And I do think there is something, you know, of course, theology of the body can shed light on this even for a third grader. And in the simple reality of understanding, like what Jesus said, my flesh is true food and my blood is true drink. If we know that Jesus is all goodness, and he knows our deep needs. His heart is wanting to give himself to us.
Yes.
And that to recognize that a vampire isn't a good guy. You know, a vampire is stealing and
taking
and harming. And so to understand that we are receiving this good gift from the Lord who shows his deep love and compassion for us in our need, that we can actually be happy, you know, that he wanted to give us himself because he loves us so much. It's the opposite of what's happening in that encounter with
well
the vampire.
Said.
And yet maybe we could pray for, if there were such a thing as a vampire, that they would know that Jesus wanted to be their real food and drink instead of what they think.
Well, vampire is a kind of a projection of our own psyche, right? When Eros gets misdirected, when that desire to take in and be nourished by infinite love, by infinite nourishment, when that gets misdirected, it does become vampire-ish.
Mm-hmm.
When Eros is fixated on finite pleasure, it wants to suck the life out of something, right? That's what you end up doing. When you aim your desire for infinite joy and nourishment at something finite, you do become vampire-ish because you're trying to suck infinity out of something that can't give it to you. And that is, I believe it's the vampire is the projection into a kind of monster and character of our imagination. We're trying to explain through this image of the vampire something we do experience in misdirected Eros. And I wouldn't, you're right, this needs to be brought to the level of a third grader, but I wouldn't hesitate in an appropriate way. Because to talk about that desire, even to a third grader, of wanting to take in, of wanting to kiss. I don't know if I was an early bloomer or what, but I know in third grade I was all about curiosity about what a kiss felt like. And if somebody would have come to me when I was in third grade and taking my desire to kiss and feel what a kiss felt like, I took it in all kinds of misdirections to kids in the neighborhood that I had no business kissing. If somebody had told me in a way I could understand that I could take that yearning to God in the Eucharist, I don't know what that would have done. Would that have spared me? Maybe. I'd like to think it could have and would have if somebody had presented it to me in a way that I could receive it. Be daring in delivering this teaching, even to the young. You will not scandalize them. You will prevent them from scandal. The real scandal is that we tell them nothing, and then they take their desires in all the wrong directions. And as a patron, Catherine, please, please take advantage of the new course that we just put up for patrons. It's Presenting Theology of the Body for Middle Schoolers. I know that's a little older than third grade, but I think you'll find lots of ideas in there from Bill Dunahy as to how to present this to a younger audience.
Our next question is from an anonymous patron. I admire my beautiful girlfriend and don't want to hide the light of her beauty under a basket. But on occasion, she likes to show a little bit of cleavage in her outfit, or the top of the seam sometimes sags loosely throughout the day. I feel protective when I see a man look at her in public. We don't fight over it, but I can't help the feeling of wanting to defend her heavenly purity. I don't know whether my desire to prevent these other men from seeing her cleavage is, quote, blaming the woman, but I can't really expect other men to have the purity to see her rightly, so I'm not sure how to approach this with her.
Wow, I'm so grateful for this question. I've never heard it quite articulated that way, and I really appreciate this questioner's sensitivity to the many different realities that need to be honored here. And I really appreciate, especially appreciate, his sensitivity not to put the blame on the woman. So lots of layers here. Let's see what we can do in just a few minutes to answer this question with at least pointing people in the right direction. Love and responsibility. The answer lies within. I've never heard articulated with such balance, nuance, and wisdom what modesty is and what modesty is not. Right? John Paul II says, immodesty in clothing is only present when the intention of the wearer of such clothing is to arouse the lust of others. I would doubt, based on what you're saying of your girlfriend, that her intention here is to arouse the lust of others. Could be, maybe is, I don't know. I would guess it's not, based on just, it sounds like there's a maturity in your relationship. But she may need a little education in the way men think. I remember, Wendy, early in our relationship, it was a summer day and you had a certain tank top you were wearing, and I felt that same protectiveness for your beauty. I didn't want men looking at you in a way that would degrade your beauty, your dignity. And I remember having some honest conversations with you about it, and I remember you were grateful that I was helping you to see things that just wasn't on your radar. Do you want to say anything about that before I add another thing that I wanted to?
Yeah, I think there was a way I was able to receive it because I didn't feel accused by you. I felt right. Like you were seeing that I was maybe naive and that that's not my fault, right. But that I should, it would help me to help others if I understood how this could affect them.
Yeah. That, and I think that's what I'd invite you to in any conversation about this with your girlfriend. You can't come at it from a place of accusing her. In fact, maybe just listen to this episode together and let it spark a conversation. I think she will feel, because I feel, the genuineness of your heart, where you really desire her true good, and you honor her beauty. You're not saying cover that up as if her body itself were shameful or her body itself was impure, right? To the pure, all things are pure, including cleavage, right? And John Paul II says, again, such nuanced and appropriate, balanced presentation of what modesty is. Listen to this. I love this. This is, again, from Love and Responsibility. He says, modesty in dress is meant to cover the sexual values of the body, but only to a certain extent, because those sexual values of the body can also and are meant to stir in others the raw material that can lead to authentic love. The raw material of love. So here's a suggestion for you as well. Whether your girlfriend is covering her cleavage or not, and I would suggest you have a conversation that would help her to understand why that would probably be a good thing. Nonetheless, other men are going to find her attractive because women are attractive. And you don't want her to go walking around in a burlap sack that covers every feminine curve of her body, because that is itself a kind of depreciation of femininity, right? Remember what John Paul II says, modesty in dress covers the sexual values of the body, but only to a certain extent, because her femininity is not an occasion of sin, right? Her femininity is an occasion of grace. And modesty has much more to do with how she carries herself as a woman than it has to do with what she wears, right? But with a little education in the fallenness of men and the way men think, I think she will naturally desire not to expose her cleavage to the world. But that does not mean men are not still going to recognize her. And this can become, for you, as one who truly knows her and loves her, this can become an occasion for you to intercede for these men that her beauty would be an occasion of grace. That she, in carrying herself with a knowledge of her dignity, would send out vibes to other men. I am not an object to be looked at as a thing for your pleasure. I'm a person made in the image and likeness of God, and you are invited not to look at me as a thing, but to see me as a person and to learn how to see a woman in the right way. You can be an intercessor for other men that they would come to see the beauty of your girlfriend in the right way. Otherwise, we get into an approach of covering the body because we think the body itself is shameful. We think the body itself is an occasion of sin. And we start to look at the world with what John Paul II calls the interpretation of suspicion, where the world becomes evil in itself. The body is evil. These are errors. These are heresies. To the pure, all things are pure. To the impure, nothing is pure. Put it this way. If a man has impure intentions, I don't care if your girlfriend's wearing a box and none of her figure is visible to any other man. If he has impure intentions, he can project them onto her even if she's wearing a box. If he has pure intentions, even if a little of her cleavage is showing, he will see that as an occasion not to lust, but to go on the journey of inner purification and learn how to see her rightly. And if she's walking, holding herself, knowing her dignity, she can dress in such a way that even some of her sexual values are on display, not in a lustful way, but she's a woman and the world's going to know she's a woman. If she's carrying herself from a heart of modesty, she's going to invite a modest and pure look. She could also be wearing a box that hides all of her shape, but also have a kind of sense of herself as a sexual object that wants to arouse the lust of men. And you can do that with your eyes. Whether any shape or form of her feminine body were on display to anybody else. So modesty, again, is much more about the inner disposition than it is about what you're wearing or not wearing.
Yeah, I love that final sentence, because I think that's really, really true, is that it is the disposition, and it does come across in many different ways. And if we are fearful of our sexual difference as if it is somehow just totally fallen and just not at all redeemed, then we have a modesty rule that's kind of just, I don't know, puritanical, just not doesn't see the goodness that God wanted us to see. So, we're all on that journey, and we're not, you know, necessarily at one or the other, like, extreme. But I think this boyfriend of this beautiful woman is knowing his own heart towards her and cautious about the hearts of others.
And rightly so, being cautious of the heart of others, hearts of others.
And that's just, I agree that it's not a matter of any wrong intention on her part, but needing to have just a little bit more awareness that could be, you know, a blessing.
John Paul II says that immodesty in dress causes depersonalization by sexualization. Now, I would change out one word. I would say depersonalization by pornification, right? I never want to use the word sexual as if it is inherently negative. Sexuality is beautiful, right? But I think this is what JP2 really means, depersonalization by pornification. But he goes on to say, this is not inevitable, right? Purity of heart is possible. It's real. Blessed are the pure of heart, for they shall see God. But it does take, John Paul rightly says, a real interior effort to see the body rightly, a real interior effort aided by grace. That's what we're after, right? I don't care if a prostitute is walking down the street with the intention to arouse the lust of every man who passes her by. We have a prior responsibility, even if she is being immodest, even if she is trying to arouse lust, a prostitute, obviously she is. We have the prior obligation to see her rightly, never to fall into depersonalization by pornification. Lord, open our eyes to the glorification, personalization by glorification of the body, rather than depersonalization by pornification. That's a new phrase. I just kind of coined it. I like it.
I want to say a little prayer.
Let's do it.
Lord, I want to lift up to you your beautiful daughters, all women. Lord, you have given us a desire to reveal beauty. And we reveal it in our own unique ways because we're all different. And you are shining through us, through our feminine bodies. You created us to reveal something of your own beauty. We call heaven like the vision of beauty.
Yes, Lord.
And that we desire to participate in that. So I want to just pray for the women listeners that all the ways that the culture has confused and messed with that desire in us and either told us we don't have beauty and don't bother trying or our beauty is all that, all our value is in our beauty, and we'd have to preserve this youthful perfection at all costs. All those different messages that are confusing, and some within the church or that might be telling us, you know, your beauty is an occasion of sin, or, you know, hide that. It's confusing. So, Lord, I ask you to shine your light in our hearts and where we feel this. Somewhere deep in there, there's a good desire to be beautiful and to have that beauty bring comfort and happiness to others. So, Lord, I ask you to help us each to receive that as a good desire that you've placed in us. And whatever freedom that brings to our hearts to know that is your gift, and allows us to shine the light you gave us to shine more brightly. I pray for that, for all the women and for all the men who are confused by the messages that they've been told about feminine beauty, and just it's convoluted and difficult to navigate. Lord, I ask you to untwist things in the hearts of men that they would experience that light of your creative goodness in women as an occasion of grace, an occasion of gratitude for your brilliance, Lord, in creating us, an occasion of seeing a person made to be loved, whose goodness is to be desired and not to be stolen or not to be fantasized about. Lord, I ask you to please purify our hearts and enable us to experience a little more brightly what you are truly communicating to us through the gift of feminine beauty.
Wendy, I that was an anointed prayer. I feel your words like a bath over my own heart. Mm-hmm. And God knows, and you know, my dear wife, how my twisted up desire for feminine beauty has wounded you, has wounded other women. When it's twisted up, it is really wounding. It's really wounding. Mm. But we can go to the other extreme and we can think, because the twisted up version is so wounding, we can think that's all there is. Your words were like a bath on my own heart. And I'm so grateful to that for that, because I need that bath. I need that bath continually. Thank you, Lord. I have been on a long journey of purification, but man, I know I have a long way to go. And only in heaven will we see rightly, completely rightly. Right? We live in that tension of the already but not yet, and walking that is like a tightrope. And it's so easy to fall off on one side or the other of that tightrope, either on the side of fear and rejection of all things physical and sexual, as if it's all bad. That would be one side of the tightrope. And the other side we can fall off is, well, everybody should just be naked if the body's good. Let's just flaunt it. Well, that doesn't do justice to our fallen world, our fallen reality. There is that tightrope, and if we keep our eyes on Jesus, we can walk it, and we can learn step by step how to rejoice in the beauty and goodness of the body in the way the Lord intends. Thank you, Wendy, for praying into that with an openness to the Holy Spirit. It really was anointed.
Mm.
Lord, please show us that path of beholding beauty rightly, so that it leads us to capital B beauty, your beauty, Lord. And you have revealed your beauty in and through the human body. You've sent your son, a male child born of a woman, to reveal through maleness and femaleness the eternal splendor of the Trinity. Open our eyes to that beauty. Amen.
Amen.
Bless you, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to this episode. We look forward to being with you again next week. If this episode has blessed you, please share it. Know it in your body. Your body person is a gift.
Become what you are.
Ask Christopher West is brought to you by the Theology of the Body Institute, with music by Mike Mangione. Christopher and Wendy hope that the information provided is helpful to you, but remind you that they are not licensed counselors. If you're going through serious difficulty, a list of trusted counselors and psychologists can be found in the show notes.